Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. In a couple seconds, you're going to hear a great talk by Dr. Shante Smalls. She gave it at our weekly Dharma gathering a couple of weeks ago on the subject of coping with loss. A very relatable topic. We've all dealt with losses, little ones, big ones. How does meditation help us? How do these teachings help us walk the path through inevitable disappointments, losses? You get it. Visit our website, nmy.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and retreats. In particular, our introductory meditation weekend, which is called Shambhala Training Weekend 1, is happening the weekend of September 15th. You can see it on our homepage. Click the link, read about it. Here is Shante Smalls.
This is a talk about coping with loss. Okay. Debbie Downer. But not really. It could easily be called coping with life, actually. And I want to talk about three. So if you go to Dharma centers, there's a lot of like three things or five things. But it's a nice way to orient. I also, in my professional life, I teach. So it's nice to sometimes have takeaways. But I want to talk about three types of loss. I'm trying to remember what they were. Okay. I remember the first and the third. I'm trying to remember the second. So loss here can mean a lot of things, from the most mundane to maybe the most ultimate, which is the loss of our own life and the lives of someone we love, right? Ultimate loss. But in our relative everyday lives, we experience all kinds of loss, whether that's missing the train, as if there won't be another one. Now, in the summer of disastrous train news, it could be a while before the next train, but there will be a next train, right? But that sense of loss and fear and frustration, and maybe there are actual real consequences, you know, being late. I've heard stories of the MTA calling people's jobs when the trains are severely delayed. So, but these small losses, missing a train or catching a stranger's eye and thinking that person is cute, maybe checking missed connections. Do people still do that? Missed connection? When you're swiping on a dating app and you swipe past someone you like by mistake and you can't go back, you haven't paid the premium. So you're like, that was the one, of course. Small losses, you know, and sometimes those small losses or small disruptions to our story can have these, you know, stronger effects. Someone cuts you off, whether you're walking or driving, or that can bring up all kinds of rage. I mean, it's really not about them cutting you off, but they just did something to you, it feels like. But we don't know each other, so really, was that happening to me, or was it just happening? So this kind of first level of loss has to do with the mundane, but the ways that the whole world can happen in these very everyday interactions. I'm not talking about something particularly bad, but just small things. Your coffee goes cold before you can drink it, or it's too hot. The Showtime kids come on the train and you just want peace and quiet. I personally love them, but I know people don't like them sometimes. And maybe these aren't really losses, but they're information from our environment. every single thing that happens can wake us up. Whether that's the things we like, someone cute smiles at us on the street, or things we don't like, a cockroach crosses our path, or we step in dog shit. All these things can help us to come to the present moment, which is the only thing we really have. And meditation, in part, helps us to not be so averse or disinterested in what's happening right now. It helps us get more curious about our own experience, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. It's not particularly about becoming, you know, I don't know, what are some ideas people have about what meditation does for you? Some of the results of meditation. Enlightened. Yes. And that enlightenment looks a particular way, right? Nothing bothers us. Everything is amazing. We even have in our slang, we even say, be Zen about it. Which is a real misinterpretation of Zen, because if you've ever been into a Zen experience, I mean, they use canes and all kinds of things to get you to meditate, so it's not so blissful. Meditation, maybe at one of its simplest forms, is about syncing up, let's even say, with what's happening. Syncing up our body and our mind together so that our mind and our body actually are in the same place at the same time, which is unusual, right? Multitasking, we're doing whatever we're doing, and our mind is having an adventure. There's nothing wrong with that, except that we are really good at that skill. We maybe have over-exercised that muscle. And we're a little weak on having our body and our mind be in the same place. So sometimes these little losses, these interruptions to our routine or our storyline can actually wake us up to the fact that maybe we're a little out of sync. And we have a choice. I can just go back to my mind being there, my body being here, or I can say, oh, what does it feel like for them to try to occupy some time together, to try to have some intimacy? And then there's maybe a different level or a more challenging level of loss, which has to do with the sense of me. So this gentleman here on my left, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, talks about in one of his books, I can't remember which one, I think it's Ruling Your World, where he says, we're very invested in the me plan. I know all about me. What can I get? How can I get it? What do I do when I don't get what I want? You're in my way. How does this affect me? Maybe it's not in such brutal terms. Maybe it's gentler or nicer, but we spend maybe most of the day thinking about ourselves. We're, as I once heard, we're the star of our own movie, and everyone else is maybe not even supporting roles, maybe they're just background. Props. And something begins to happen when we start to switch our allegiance from kind of a selfishness, self-centeredness, to a kind of mindfulness or awareness. It doesn't mean that I disappear and that I'm a non-entity, but rather I begin to experience the world not from the sense of lack or from a sense of me against the world or people out to get me, but from a sense of synchronization with my environment, a sense of curiosity about the world and my place in it. And that dissolution of the solidity or the solidness of myself actually is dizzying in its disorientation. This gentleman, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, once said that in talking about a particular orientation in Buddhism, that we could regard the loss of kind of home or the loss of sense of self as actually a cheerful occasion, because we were actually exploring the world with new eyes. We could leave that comfortable place that seemed like it was our source of resourcefulness, but actually was a trap, a gilded cage or golden handcuffs. In Shambhala, we call it the cocoon. We are a larva that never turns into a butterfly because we've taken up shop in our comfortable discomfort, whatever that looks like for each of us. Actually, there's a, I was just reading today in this really great book called Radical Dharma, Talking Race, Love, and Liberation. And it's by Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, who's a Zen priest. She says that she's married to Zen, but Shambhala is her lover. That's what she says about Shambhala. And also Lama Rod Owens, who is a high teacher in the Kagyu tradition, one of the second oldest school of Tibetan Buddhism, and then another Zen practitioner, Jasmine Sayadula. So Lama Rod Owens has this to say about the loss of me, a sense of self. As I have moved in my life, I have also experienced the death of who and what I was before the movement. I remember not as an act of moving back into the past, but as a memorial to the struggle of movement. I remember to offer myself the grace to grieve for the person I used to be. In the sentiment of my home community, I may not be where I'm going, but I'm grateful that I'm not where I used to be. And here he was talking about growing up, small town in the South, and his road to becoming a Buddhist practitioner and a Buddhist teacher, and that had to do with this dissolution of what he thought he knew about himself and who he thought he was through some, you know, painful experiences. I'm sure none of us can relate to that, right? And this sense of self that dissolves doesn't have to be bad news. We can regard that as actually good news, because we're actually really getting to know our true selves as we begin to slowly see through the ways that we defend ourselves from authentic experiences. Those defenses turn from being helpful, maybe when we were a child or younger, to being prison. And in Shambhala, we talk about a curious phrase called basic goodness. And it's something I've contemplated for a long, long time. Well, over a decade, so long in some senses and really short. And this sense of basic goodness that is inherent to all of us and all things doesn't have anything really to do with good or bad. Like, I'm good or I'm bad. But instead, it has to do with the quality of wakefulness that is inherent in all of us and really in all things. However, that inherent wakefulness, that inherent intelligence that tells us fire is hot, don't put your hand in it. Or you do it once and you know not to do it again, perhaps. That inherent intelligence and wakefulness and inherent ability to see clearly is obscured by habits. By doubting that we are worthy, that we have basic worthiness. And instead, looking for things. This is not to say that we don't live life and have adventures and fall in love and eat food and party and have a good time. It's to say that none of those things make us worthy or not worthy. We actually have all we need because we're alive. And we're human, and we're here. So it starts to get shaky when the sense of who we are begins to dissolve. I remember being somewhat early in my journey in Shambhala. And maybe I had been practicing for a couple years. And I, like many people I knew at the time, and maybe some of you, came to Shambhala or came to meditation generally in a state of emergency. I was in a crisis. The shape of my crisis took the form of a romantic relationship that had fallen apart. But it hadn't just fallen apart. It was that that relationship was the zeitgeist of all of my habits that had gotten me through every relationship I had ever had. All the little tricks I played, all the little games, the ways I fooled myself and other people, the kind of people I chose so that I could always be the hero of my own movie. And you know, I met my match. And what happened was I saw through incredible pain exactly what I had been doing. And I was at a loss. I knew I couldn't keep going that way, but I just had no idea of how to. I thought that was me. I didn't know how to be different. And I had dipped my toes in here a little while, and I started really coming because I was so, I don't know, sad, angry, heartbroken, so uncomfortable in my own skin. Like if I could have peeled off my skin and aired it out, sent it to the laundry, I would have. I wanted to be anywhere else. So funny. Someone who had spent a lot of time thinking about themselves. I wanted to be anyone else but me. For a while. And maybe I had been coming here a couple years, practicing, doing some trainings, really trying to find myself, going on retreats far away, putting a lot of hours in on the cushion, fantasizing what it would be like to become a monastic. Then I went to the Gampo Abbey, and I was like, nope, not for me. It's like, they don't even let you eat sugar. Anyway, only one day a week, you know. And one day it just occurred to me that it was okay. Nothing had changed. I just felt the result of practice, which was that I was okay. I don't know if I ever felt that in my life. I was okay as I was. If I never had another relationship, if I never got the thing, if I never got that, I was okay. Now, that feeling didn't last, but it was there. I touched into it, and it could be experienced again and again and again. So this loss that I experienced, right? This disillusion of, oh, I'm so good. I'm so, I'm the thoughtful one. I'm so like emotionally mature. I'm so present. The disillusion of that set of tactics that I used to hide from real intimacy. That gave me a new relationship to myself and to other people. One that maybe I had been running from. But how do we deal with maybe the most challenging kinds of losses? The ending of a relationship or a marriage, real catastrophes, homelessness, one's own or others, or addiction, and the way that addiction lays waste to lots of lives, or death. So there are no easy answers, but I remember I would come to the Tuesday night Dharma talks, and it seemed like, I shit you not, every week the talk was about death and suffering. I was like, really? Is that, that's all? That what we got? I mean, I kind of loved it. I was like, yes, so true, so true. So sometimes, you know, Buddhist talks are like, really? Because these are things we contemplate, because not because we're morbid, but because they are... The first things the Buddha taught was suffering, the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, and the liberation from suffering, like the Four Noble Truths. So it's a foundational, it's like if you're a hip-hop fan, you know the foundations of hip-hop. I'm a hip-hop fan. So these foundational teachings have to do with why we suffer and why we suffer, but and not moving away from the reality of the conditionality of our lives, right? Everything that arises will eventually dissolve after it abides for a time. But saying those words and having the experience of that, very, very different things. And, you know, it's not like I hadn't experienced loss or death, but when my mom was dying, it was very unreal. And it was very shocking. I don't ever remember her being sick my whole life. And I was not living in New York at the time, so it was even harder. I was having to fly back here to see her. And at the very end of her life, maybe the last few months, she couldn't talk on the phone. She just, it was very hard for her. So I could only talk to her in person, and that was almost impossible because she was not, she had lost her mind. And so I remember the last, she was in hospice, and my brother, older brother, called me, and I flew up here, and he said, you know, this is it. And every time I saw her, a little bit of who I knew Gloria to be had gone. And I remember coming into the hospice room and seeing her sweet little face, being shocked at the ravages that cancer had done to her body and mind, and just the tears, you know, just, but also having to kind of hold it together because she didn't really know her transition was happening. And I can still recall us feeding her, you know, soup, broth. And she would have 2 teaspoons and be like, oh, I'm full. And I would be like losing my mind because it was so sad and painful. But there was humor. You know, we were telling jokes and we were laughing. And she had all these people who had known her since she was like 18. She was like 60-something when she died. Coming and visiting, and, you know, the hospice staff was like, this is amazing. And they'd kick some of us out. There were like 20 people in her room, and it was sort of phenomenal. And we had spent, you know, every day she was leaving this life a little bit more and more. And I remember sitting with her till about 11:30 one night, and I knew this was it. It was the last time I was going to see her alive. And we went home, and I got a call maybe 5.5 hours later that she had died. And the crying, you know, my brothers and my grandmother and my father, and we were just, I was without my mommy. And when we went to the hospital to see her body, and I was like, she's gone. And I cried because I loved my mother, as difficult as she was and as difficult as I was. And I called friends who had experienced that loss. And I was so, so, so incredibly grateful that she got to have all her babies there with her. And I have never experienced anything like that. And there was a quality of sharpness. For any of you who've experienced death of a loved one, or maybe you've come close to death yourself, there was my senses were so awake. It was sort of unbelievable. It was like I saw everything and tasted everything and heard everything and smelled everything with such a poignancy. Her funeral, which I can recall, it was unbelievable. It was a transformative experience. And as I could hold these two things in my heart, of a depth of sadness that I have never experienced, and a tremendous, I don't know if joy is the word, but we say broken-hearted sadness. And working with all those feelings, sadness, anger at her for dying, you know, lots of family turmoil and fallout after the complete rearrangement of my family structure after my mom's death. We found out a lot about each other and about our relationship to each other after she died. And the sense of preciousness and tenderness that continues even though she's no longer on this earth. The relationship that I've been able to develop with her even after she died has been very fascinating. And so one of the things that's been most helpful for me is learning how to turn toward that thing I think is gonna break me. Turn toward it. I don't have to run to it or have any kind of aggression, but just turn toward it and take in what I can take in. Maybe that's a little bit or maybe that's a lot, but I don't have to have any sense of supposed to. I can have a sense of what's happening now. And, you know, most importantly, I don't have to do these things alone. Sometimes I feel like in meditation or in meditation communities, there's a sense that we kind of meditate alone and then live our lives. But as we can see here, meditation is also really a communal act. And in all the kinds of losses that I face or experienced, I let people offer me the kindness of taking care of me when I need it. That's an act of kindness to other people, to let them help you when they're offering. And I, in turn, can do a similar thing. I think I've said enough, so I'd love to hear from all of you. Any questions or thoughts that you have are welcome.
So I am 3.5 months into grief of my mother's transition. Mm. So I find myself, and I love the point that you said you also grieve the loss of yourself, because that is a transition. I didn't even think of that. I am grieving the loss of who I am and what that looks like and what I'm supposed to be. Mm. I'm finding it, I'm trying to do it right.
Yes.
And
yes.
Be brave on the cushion and cry when I'm supposed to, but then be happy. And it's still not working, which is maybe the control factor, but that's not working. And then maybe it's just time. I don't know. But if you could shed some light on that,
sure,
that would be great.
So thank you for your question, and I am sorry for your loss. It's a big one. It's very real. Can you say something about the quality of when you feel like you're present and the quality when you feel like you're trying to brave, or the other quality.
Right. So the quality of when I'm present feels right.
Yeah.
As in, I'm present, I'm assured this is what's supposed to be happening.
Yeah.
And then the quality of when I'm fighting it feels wrong, but ego tells me that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
I see.
Because being out of control, what does that look like?
Yes. Okay, great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I know that feeling well. And that... So ego does not want to die. It is so resilient. I mean, it's a part of us, but it's a part that's been given way too much power. And it's important for our development, but when ego stops us from experiencing experience, well, we're going to experience it anyway, but... It's like, how are we going to experience it? Through the filter of ego, which has a lot to say about our experience. So, you know, like when you're on the cushion and you're just having your experience, your leg is twitching, your neck is itchy, thoughts are occurring, and ego's like, wrong, pounce, this, or just think that thought. No one can tell you what to think, you know, or whatever. Just, you know, the crazy kind of talk, you know, where it's like, ego turns our experience into an enemy that we have to defeat, right? So 3.5 months after your mom's death is like a really short time. So you can like give yourself a break. You can give yourself a break. And even with ego, you could be like, yeah, okay, there you go. You're trying to help me. Maybe I don't need you right now. Or, okay, I'll let you do your thing. You can let ego wear itself out. Really on the cushion is where you can do that. You can just let it just think or just space out or just whatever. Let it run its course. And then say, okay, I'm going to, like, sit with a little bit of diligence for, like, 3 minutes. So we give ourselves some space. And then we give ourselves a little bit more of a container, short periods of time. And what I think will begin to happen is you'll notice, and maybe you'll notice with commentary, and then maybe you'll begin to notice and just kind of be like, laugh a little bit, have a kind of sense of humor at the ways that we have such a hard time experiencing whatever it is, you know, boredom or pain or sadness or fear. But the sense of kindness toward ourselves, including our ego, is so important. Being gentle toward ourselves, feeling brave when you feel brave, feel sad when you feel sad. It sounds so simple, but it's so hard to actually do. A couple weeks ago, I was coming here, and I had a phone message from my best friend, one of my best friends in the world. She's like, I'm your best friend. Anyway, whatever. So she'll probably listen to this podcast. She'll know who I'm talking about. But, and it was, she's very busy. I'm very busy. And we've known each other since we were teenagers. And she left me this message that was so sweet. And I am like a very, or I should say I have been in my life, someone who's very mindful of how I appear in the world. And one of the things, interesting things that's happened as I become a fairly serious, I mean, a meditation teacher, fairly serious meditator, is that I've become less concerned, not necessarily aware, but less concerned with how I look in public. Although I'm aware of how I appear. And this message just pierced my heart. I'm like weeping on Broadway and 19th Street. I had to like lean on a pole. I was like, it was just so beautiful. It was so tender, and I heard it. And my response was just to, I just I mean, I collapsed in tears. It was sort of unbelievable. And as I was crying, it was early Saturday morning, so there weren't that many people out, thankfully. But I also experienced this exuberant joy almost. It was a very interesting set of feelings that were happening. It was like a compound. It touched me so deeply, and I just started weeping, but I also felt this openness, this spaciousness that I called joy. So it wasn't that I was happy, but I experienced my own spaciousness, my own wakefulness, and it brought me both to tears and it brought a sense of refreshment. So I think if you can just be kind to yourself, be gentle with yourself. It was probably 3 years before I felt like I had gone to the next phase. So I gave myself a lot of space and time. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, hi. I'm just curious if the Buddhist meaning of ego is any way similar to the Freudian definition.
No, I mean, they cross over. So there's a tanka in the back here of a figure called Mahakala. There's a lot of Dungeons and Dragons stuff that happens in Tibetan Buddhism, but the figure is an interesting one because the Tibetans really were interested in rendering energies. I'm getting to your question, I swear. So we have Yeshe Sogyal, you're sitting next to, who's like lightened figure of compassion and wisdom and wakefulness, and does that through things like spaciousness and beauty. And then we have someone like Mahakala, who cuts the throat of ego. So ego sometimes is rendered as the enemy. Why? Because it actually keeps us from experiencing our inherent basic goodness, or in Buddhist terms, bodhicitta, our awakened heart. I mean, one could make an argument. There is a book called Psychoanalysis in Buddhism that's very good. So if you're interested in that, you could read that book. Whereas Freudian ego, I mean, Freud has, it's not a talk about Freud, but Freud has interesting things to say about the ego and the ways that ego can become a trap as well. With the id and the superego, ego, our drives and all of that. So there are, it's a different worldview, maybe talking about the same phenomena. And there are certainly consonants, but they're very different ways of working with them. So Freud's solution is talk therapy. Our solution, sit on the cushion. You can do those things together, very helpful. Not at the same time, obviously, but right. But for Buddhists, the ego is really the block, blocks our experience of authentic presence. Is that helpful? Okay.
The reference to just it being okay and coming to terms with something, with the loss of your relationship, I have experienced that with, you know, a loss of a job and or an injury, and it's like after 2 years I just go, okay, it's
yeah.
Okay. You know, I can still go back into this place yeah. of work, for example, where I got, you know, seriously lost my position, and I can still face people, and it's okay. And I think a lot of it was, for me, just about depersonalizing it. And, I mean, part of that, it's okay, is just really, yeah, getting to that point of feeling safe, somehow again. But so that was very powerful for me to hear you say that again. But something I'm struggling with, I think, on more than I want to, is loss related to disappointment, and where it isn't a parent dying or a major job loss, or you know, but really not that important in the scheme of things. But I make it more important than it needs to be, particularly in like you know friendships and whatnot.
Yes,
and so. I'd love to hear your thoughts on expectations and disappointment and perhaps some things that you can think about in a more premeditative way. And
yeah. Thank you. Yeah, sure. I experienced that too. So I think it has something to do with the relationship of the endless cycle between hope and fear. Expectation's almost like a demand that's sometimes unspoken. Or expectation can be like a measure we have for ourselves that we apply to other people, which is like a very human thing to do. Oh, I, you know, it's like water rises to its own level or whatever, you know, so this kind of thing, like this is how I act in friendships and that's reasonable to expect other people. But if our expectations aren't matching up with reality, that's sometimes where we can get in a little bit of trouble, where we have an idea or an ideal and we're actually not paying attention to the what's happening. And usually it's, you know, after one or two or three times, we can kind of tell someone's how they, you know, what their deal is. How they operate. Maybe we even say something. But this doesn't mean we can't be disappointed or hurt. But it's interesting to think about what we're asking for versus what is actually happening. And sometimes I feel like that's all the trouble in the world. Where it's like, oh, this is what I want to be occurring. And the gap between that and what's actually occurring is wide. And when we get resentful, it is a poison that only hurts us. It is a form of self-aggression and anger that we think we're like directing at another person with our mind, but we're the ones experiencing it. And it's a trap. It's a hell. Or like, you know, you see that person and you walk the other, you know, you cross the street or something, or you get that feeling in your chest, either a burning or a kind of nausea in your stomach or anger in your fist or something. And you realize that's inside of you. And so sometimes we need to work with that by addressing it first in ourselves, like get clear on what's happening, and maybe we need to address it with that person or another person. But fundamentally, looking at this cycle of hope and fear, of like wanting this will, if this goes right, everything will be, I can relax, you know? And if this goes wrong, all bets are off, you know? I don't think we can have good lives if we live in a constant cycle of elation and depression. I just think it's too hard on us emotionally. It's too painful. Whereas we can experience elation and depression as experiences versus as kind of like a ride or something. So this is not a don't relate to other people But it's a, how do we relate? If I keep getting disappointed, maybe I'm being vulnerable with the wrong kinds of people. Maybe I'm trying to make relationships with people that don't want to make the same kind of relationships with me. Maybe I have to seek out the people who I've said are too boring or something. You know, like when you're a teenager and you're like, there's like the bad kid or whatever, and like they're so hot to you because they're so bad. Maybe that's just me, but you know what I mean? Like the bad boy or the bad girl is like so sexy because they're just like doing whatever they want to do. But that's not the person who probably, you know what I mean, you're going to like go to IKEA with or whatever, you know what I mean? And like... make a partnership with, you know? But it's like there's something about that kind of flair, that energy, that's very magnetizing. But if we see it for what it is, which is maybe it's just like a flare versus like, you know, something more long-term, we might have a different relationship to it. You know, for me, like, you know, work, the investment in work is so, I mean, I don't know, between the Japanese, the Americans, and the Germans, our investment in work, I mean, it's ludicrous. It's work. I mean, it's not, you know what I mean? And there can be a sense of joy and all of that from work, but the kind of, when you make it, try to do more, then it, there's nothing but disappointment, you know? And I think all of these things take time, because I think a lot of times we try to find fault with ourselves or fault with others, and sometimes it's about an adjustment. Not like no one's to blame, but it's like an adjustment.
When you said that you were a dog person, I'm a dog person also, so it made me start thinking about also the idea that everything arises, abides, and dissolves. And then I, you know, when I got my dog, and to this day I look at him sometimes and I say, I voluntarily got you. You're going to bring me great joy and guaranteed despair.
Yes.
One day.
Yes.
Why? And it's as though we are, you know, we constantly as humans bring things into our lives that are going to bring us temporary joy and guaranteed loss.
Okay.
And that could be in the form of you know, having a child. They're going to leave one day, and they're going to leave you, you know, a 50-year-old person who needs to find something to do. You know, so it's a very human thing to. You know, voluntarily bring things into our lives that we're going to have to eventually deal with their loss.
Yes.
Do you have any insight into that?
Okay. Tell me your name.
I'm Eric.
Eric. Today's one of my dog's 10th birthday. So I adopted him 9 years ago. I named him after a Buddhist saint. His name is Talopa. If you know anything about Talopa, Talopa was this teacher who would like slap his students in the face with his slipper. I don't know. He was like sandal. And his famous, one of his most famous students was Naropa, who ended up being this prolific scholar. And there's Naropa famous university in India. Also, Shambhala has a university here, Naropa University in Colorado. And I, you know, I lost the dog in the breakup, so I would like wander around New York, like into dog parks, be like, "Oh, which one's your dog?" I'm like, no one, no dog. And I'd be like, "Okay, weirdo, get out of the dog run." Like, seeing dog, oh, let me. Anyway, I was that person. So I got this dog, and I saw him, and I was like. On the whatever pet finder, and I was gonna foster him, so that I saw him and I was like, I love you. You know, it was like instant. There was no, and he was a disaster. Like this dog was, I can't even tell you how much money I spent getting him trained to be appropriate. So he could, like, not, yeah, he was a lunatic. There were stories. But anyway, I learned so much about myself. So much about myself. I was like, oh, I'm this peaceful person. And then he would act up. I'd be like, motherfucker. You know, like, I would, like, lose my mind. I remember one day, like, looking at him, and I was like, you can't throw him out the window. Like, that's not... And I was like, either you're going to, like, get professional help to, like, help you work with this. You've reached the limit of your abilities to work with this dog. Or you're going to, if you give him back, he will go, he was on death row. He will die. And I was like, I am going to hire someone to help me. So I learned all these skills. I learned how to work with dogs. Like, you know, I learned how to work with him. We have this incredible relationship. And, you know, he's 10 now. And I have to have a picture of him when he's, like, a year and a half in here with his best friend, Albert. And I look at him, I'm like, don't you dare die. Don't you dare die. And I'm like, thinking about how sad I'm going to be. Like, I love this dog and his sister. But at the same time, what would my life have been without this animal? The things that I have learned, the people that I have met, the friendships that I have formed because your dog decides it likes another dog's butt smell, and you then become friends with the dog's human. The time I spend in Prospect Park because of my dogs. So everything that we do is conditional. And so everything that's conditional will arise, abide, and dissolve. That's our whole lives. From the clothes we wear to the food we eat to our own bodies. We can think about the way our bodies have changed. When I look at pictures of me as a baby, I'm like, how was I that? And now I'm this, right? So the problem is not that things are temporary, or even that we have attachments. Is that when those attachments dissolve, it's very, do we know how to work with that situation? It's okay to feel pain. I mean, there's no way I would trade, you know, I'll get the appropriate tattoos when he dies or whatever, and I've already decided what it's going to be. Yeah, that's right. So, but just the joy that I've experienced and the life that I've experienced, and frankly, the joy that he's brought to other people, you know, I think that that's important. And he will die, I will die, you will die. You know what I mean? And I think about between my birth and my death, what is the quality of my life? What are the experiences that I'm having with the world? For me, that feels like so important. So that when I experience sadness, I can experience sadness. When I experience joy, I can experience joy. I don't think it's about not doing those things. You know, I buy flowers every week. They're so amazing. We pick them and then so they die. But the kind of wakefulness that looking at a flower can actually bring me is very powerful. It's helped me to notice things differently in the world. So, yeah. This is our experience, is even when, you know, I remember I used to have such a hard time with goodbyes when people would move, and I'd be like, I would disappear. If someone was like moving in 3 months, I'd be like, see ya, nice knowing you. I couldn't handle it. Or if I was moving, I would just disappear from relationships. You know, now I'm like, I can still maintain a relationship with someone who's not right in front of me. You know, I can call people and say, I've been thinking about you. How are you? I miss you. And so I think for a long time I thought self-protection was how I got through life. But now it's more, I kind of lead with my open heart. So snug your doggo, you know, enjoy that time. There's a great cartoon or a comic by The Oatmeal. He writes just about this. He does this beautiful comic strip about how this dogs love you and they don't even know your name. You know, and then, you know, they have these short lives, and but all the joy that comes from relating to an animal, you know, a companion species, as they say. Tibetan Buddhists actually, in terms of reincarnation, they actually have said that dogs have a lower place than cats. I'm like, well, we disagree there. So anyway, I love cats too. But there is something very powerful about relating. I actually learned how to relate better to humans actually by relating to this dog. So it's a very powerful thing that we're able to do. Okay. So on that note, maybe we can just bow out.
Thank you, Shante Smalls. I'm this close to going out and getting a dog right now. I'm this close. Visit our website, nydrbala.org, for all of our upcoming courses, retreats. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Come to our weekly Dharma gathering. It happens every Tuesday night, guys. Every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. Meet the teachers, meet the other people. And it's great. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, anecdotes, whatever you got. Riddles, jokes, I'm bored. And thanks for listening. Later.